Okay, so welcome to Introduction to Virtual Machines, class number two here. Again, last class I mentioned that we're going to talk about three of the main virtualization platforms. There are a lot of virtualization platforms out there, and there's a reason that we focus on only three of them. So one of the things that the business industry does is analyze growth trends, analyze business data, and see what people are doing. One company that does that is called Gartner. So a lot of PC industries look at the Gartner data to see what Gartner's reporting for trends in the industry. So one of Gartner's things that they do is they make this magic quadrant. Well, this magic quadrant actually shows hardware vendors and what they're doing. So this particular magic quadrant deals with server virtualization infrastructure. So as we go to the left, they have kind of an incomplete vision. That means that they don't understand where they're going. They're still a growing company. They're still trying to define who they are. As you go to the right, they have a complete vision of where they are, what they're doing, who they are as a company, and what kind of product that they make. Towards the bottom, says that they have an inability to execute. That means they don't have a large operating budget. They're just starting out. Again, they don't have a lot of money. As you move to the top, it means that they have more money that they can pour into research, develop new features, things of that nature. So again, as you're looking at this kind of quadrant, you want to look at the people who are in the upper right-hand quadrant. So if you look at the leaders of our virtualization platforms, what do we have? We have VMware. So VMware was first to the market. So VMware is a huge player. VMware ESXi and VMware vSphere are huge. In terms of VDI solutions, again, virtual desktop infrastructure that we'll talk more about, Horizon or Vue is huge with VMware, so they have a big market for that. So again, they're a leader. A lot of people use them in business. A lot of people have VMware installed in their system. Another leader, Microsoft, Hyper-V. Again, installs automatically with Server 2012 R2. Started installing automatically, I think, in 2008 with their servers. Before that, it was Virtual PC. If anybody remembers that back in the day, that was kind of crap. But they've come a long way. They've done a lot of things, and they're competing on par with VMware now. And again, we'll talk more about the differences between those two. Again, that's why we focus really on those two. So down in this lower right-hand corner, you see there's a lot more of them in here. Citrix, Oracle, Red Hat. So there's some Linux KVM in there. That's a growing market. We don't really focus on that. Again, what we choose to focus on is Xen. Xen is how Oracle implements their virtualization platform. Xen is how Citrix implements their virtualization platform. So really, we have a complete coverage of the main virtualization platforms by talking about those three specific industry leaders. Make sense? Fair enough? Hopefully by the end of this course, you'll realize it doesn't matter what the virtualization platform is. They all work pretty much the same. So even if we had talked about 100 different virtualization platforms, you can do all the same things in all of them. Again, the differences are how they operate, the ease of use. And again, you can make your decisions on which one's better than other ones. And again, we'll compare and contrast some of them. And in your short papers, you'll be asked to kind of deep dive and pick out some nitpicky objects between the different vendors. And by the end, you should have a good feel of which vendor you choose. I try not to influence you. I have my opinions. I have my biases. I don't want you to know what those are. I want you to know that there are different platforms out there. They do different things. They work differently. And depending on your business need, depending on what your business does, there's no one solution that's best, right? And again, we'll go more into detail on that as we progress throughout the course.
Even if they were second, they should still trump. So I'm curious who
So VMware is its own company. So the way that VMware stays on top of the market is that they're first to the market with new features.
Okay.
So when things start to come out, usually it's VMware who introduces them. Another thing that all of these hypervisors do is they partner with other companies. So you'll find a company that makes storage area networks. A big one out there is EMC. EMC was bought by Dell. Companies like to buy companies all the time for their features, rip them off and resell them. So EMC says that they integrate fully with VMware, full support.
Okay.
Dell says they're a VMware hardware platform. And again, as we talk more VMware, you'll see VMware has a hardware compatibility list. That hardware compatibility list defines what operating systems were designed to specifically work with their software well. So if you buy a virtualization platform, you're going to buy that hardware. So people kind of push that thing, yes.
Okay.
So again, VMware is not Microsoft, but Microsoft, when they first entered the virtualization platform, they didn't do what people needed to do. So the early adopters, again, adopted VMware, and a lot of them have stuck with it.
Right, okay. That makes sense.
Yep, and there's a lot of people out there who understand VMware. People who are fully integrated with Hyper-V, not as many.
Right.
It's a lot harder to get information for Hyper-V than it is VMware. But again, Hyper-V built into Microsoft, so you get those Microsoft certified professionals. They fully understand it. It does everything they needed to do. So again, we're going to start with Chapter 1. We're going to cover Chapter 1 and Chapter 2 today. So as we start out, we're going to describe what virtualization is. We're going to talk about the three properties that are outlined for efficient virtual machines. We're going to talk about and understand the key trends that drive the virtualization process, why virtualization is so prominent today, and why it will be prominent in the future, and understand why virtualization is key technology in growing data centers. So what is virtualization? When I say virtual platform, what am I talking about? Virtual. So what does that mean? What does virtual mean? It's not actually present. So I saw a good picture on Facebook the other day, and it was that image from The Matrix with the kid holding the spoon. You know, there is no spoon. It basically said there is no cloud, right? Because virtualization doesn't mean that there's no hardware involved. There is a computer, there is hardware involved somewhere. It's just abstracting away from that hardware. So when we talk about virtual machines, we don't think of it as a physical machine. It does run on a physical machine. It has to, right? Something has to be putting it out there. It doesn't exist in that ether of computing technologies. It doesn't exist in the wires of the internet. Now, there's actually a hardware driving that software to work. But we move away from the specific designs of the hardware, the specific limitations of the hardware, and we move into an environment where we're not directly interfacing with the hardware. So as we go on today, we're going to start talking about hypervisors, and hypervisors really are that medium that allow us to move away from the hardware and move into our virtual platform. So again, physical devices exist somewhere. We still run on physical devices. But we're moving away from that when we talk virtual machines. Virtualization, we think of it sort of as a new idea. Again, it started coming out mainstream in the late 90s. Really 2000 started to see an increased use of it. Even today, there's a lot of places who don't have a virtual infrastructure in place. It's kind of scary how much money that they could save if they put a virtual infrastructure in place, but they don't, because they understand how physical servers work. They understand what physical hardware is. But again, this kind of what is virtual doesn't mean as much to them. But again, the ideas of virtualization came out in the 1960s, codified in the 1970s by Popek and Goldberg's three principles. So the three principles are fidelity, isolation or safety, and performance. So an efficient virtual machine manager or hypervisor has all three of these different properties to define their virtual environment. So So fidelity means that the virtual environment should be identical to the physical environments. An end user using a virtual machine should not know that they are using a virtual machine, right? As far as they're concerned, it's a physical machine that exists somewhere in the universe, and they're using a physical machine that exists. As developers, as administrators, we know we're using a virtual machine, but it shouldn't make a difference on how it operates or how we interact with it. We're going to treat it like it was a physical hardware. Isolation or safety, so virtual machine managers should have control of the system resources. Again, if you think of a big provider like Amazon, Amazon hosts cloud solutions for people to actually go and make virtual machines out on the internet. If you're a customer of Amazon, you don't want another customer of Amazon to be able to access your information, right? You want them completely separate, completely segregated in their own environments. The only people who have control over them are the hypervisors, are the virtual machine managers on the back end. And again, all those are going to do are facilitate the transfer between the virtual infrastructure and the physical hardware medium that they're operating on. Performance, again, there should be little or no difference between the performance of a virtual machine and an actual machine. If virtual machines were a lot slower than physical machines, nobody would use virtual machines, right? This doesn't do what I needed to do. It's too slow. I'm going to use a physical machine. Again, in terms of hypervisors, we're going to talk the different types of hypervisors. You may be running a Type 2 hypervisor on a machine, and the performance that you're going to see from a Type 2 hypervisor is going to be a little bit slower because you're using an operating system, the operating system's drawing resources, and then you're trying to draw resources from the operating system. It's going to slow things down. Not the same in a Type 1 environment, and again, we'll go more into detail of that as we get there. So originally they called them virtual machine monitors. Again, I use the term hypervisor. Everybody now uses the term hypervisor. Very few people refer to them as virtual machine monitors or virtual machine managers. Basically, what they do is they sit on top of a physical server or host. So you have your physical device that has all of the physical components, CPU, memory, hard drives, disk drives, things of that nature. Then we have this software that's going to sit on top of that, that's going to control the interactions with that hardware. On top of that, we have virtual machines, which have what's called a guest operating system. So the physical device is the host, and the hosts invite the guests to the party. Because virtual infrastructure is a huge party, right? Everybody has fun. No laughter. Okay. It's going to be a long class if you guys don't laugh at my stupid jokes, all right? I'm just saying. So again, the guest operating systems are going to act independently of each other. You're going to install your own versions of whatever software you're using. Maybe it's Windows 7. Maybe it's Windows 8. Maybe I'll scare you all and make you install Windows 10. Could be Linux. Mac operating systems are a little harder in the virtual environment. They do exist. People do use them. Typically, it's the other way around. But again, all the interactions with the physical hardware are going to go through the virtual machine monitor or a hypervisor. A virtual machine monitor is not an operating system. So typically, in our view of computers, we see the operating system is installed on top of the physical host. And then within the operating system, we do the other software. So it's easy to think of it as an operating system, but it's incorrect. It's not an operating system. It only deals with interactions between the guest operating systems and the physical host. That might come up on a test later, just saying. So really, what drove the need to facilitate moving to a virtual environment? Windows. Right? So when Windows came out, Windows said, I'm going to have a server, and this server is going to perform some function. I'm going to have a server that's going to act as a firewall. I'm going to have another server, and that server is going to act as a mail server. I'm going to have another server, and that server is going to act as a domain controller. So we got all these servers sitting in our data center that all have a single purpose. But Windows, with all its bloat, with all its operatings, sits and does nothing a lot of the time. That idle process is the process that runs the most, right? Firewalls, you know, when traffic starts to come in or traffic starts to go out, it has to look at that. But if there's no traffic, it's sitting around idle. Mail servers, when mail comes in or mail goes out, we need to look at that. But other than that, we're going to sit and do nothing. So Windows kind of forced this one server, one application process. They wanted to sell machines, right? If you're going to buy a computer from me, it's only going to do this one thing. Right? That's okay, right? People bought them. Just saying, your fault. So this guy at Intel called Moore came up with a law called Moore's Law. It's not really a law. Laws can be broken, right? And people have extended the law into things that don't really apply. But basically, what he said was that the number of processors on a silicon chip is going to double every 18 months. So what does the number of processors on a chip doubling every 18 months do? It increases the power and the performance of the computer. Computers are going to get faster. Computers are going to get better. Right? People have taken this Moore's Law and they've extended it. They said the amount of memory that we're going to need is going to double every 18 months. The amount of hard drive space that we're going to need is going to double every 18 months. And they quote Moore's Law. Well, Moore's Law is finite, right? There's only so many physical things that you can fit on a chip before you're going to run out of space, right? So quantum computing exists. There are quantum computers out there now. They are not mainstream production. You can't go buy one. I would like to see you try. And if you have that much money, you should just give it to me and we'll call it good. So the way that they get around that is, again, adding more processors to the chip. So now when we talk cores, when we talk sockets, we deal with that so that the chips have more than one socket. They usually have more than one core in those sockets. And again, we'll get to that as we move along here as well. So again, data centers were growing, Windows servers driving the data center growth. We need more space. We need more power. We need more AC because it's getting really hot in here with all these servers. And again, most of those servers are just sitting around doing nothing, right? Drawing power to run Windows, but not really the functions that we want within Windows. So we have to worry about power. We have to worry about cooling. We have to run physical cabling to those devices. If you take intro to networking, we talk about the cost of Ethernet cable. We talk about the cost of fiber. If you have 50 servers in a server room, you have to run cables to each one of those. Then you also have to have a switch to be able to plug those 50 connections into. So now you're talking money upon money upon money upon money. You have square footage. Space is not cheap, right? $1.80-something now a square foot for office space. So, do you want it to just house equipment? Probably not. Security. We have a stack of 50 servers. That's not looking appealing to anybody, right? Yeah, people want to steal servers. Those bad people out there. So now we need to hire a guy to stand there and watch those servers. We need to put card readers on our doors. Not locks, card readers. We want to have cameras inside our server room to watch and monitor all the time. Maybe we're going to get some room alert sensors. If the temperature raises in the room, we want to know if it gets to 80 degrees in the server room so that we can go and fix the air conditioner or open a window to cool it down. So Moore's Law, again, saying all these servers now, they're getting faster, they're getting more powerful, but they're still not doing anything more than they were doing before, right? So back in the day, I had a 33 megahertz computer that ran awesome stuff. Now I have, you know, a 3 gigahertz computer, but my 3 gigahertz computer is doing the same functions as my 33 megahertz computer, so it's not really doing anything more, right? I have all this power, but I'm not using it. So So now what we want to do is we want to take our servers and we want to combine the functions of our servers into singular devices. So the ways that we can push virtualization forward are through two different things, consolidation or containment. So consolidation says that we're going to take our existing servers, we're going to put them all together into the same machine, and we're going to run them on a single host. So in terms of virtualization, we have a consolidation ratio. Again, different hypervisors, different hardware are going to have different consolidation ratios. They say for servers, usually it's 10 to 1. So each virtual host can run 10 servers on it. If you're talking workstations in a VDI environment, again, virtual desktop environment, that consolidation ratio goes up. Again, workstations aren't going to do the work of a server. So most of the time they're sitting around doing nothing, we can fit more workstations in. The consolidation ratio for a workstation, usually 15 or 20 to 1. The other way that we can do it is through containment. Containment is deploying our new applications in a virtual infrastructure. You're going to roll out a new server? Well, let's roll out a new virtual server, right? Don't put physical hardware into my environment. I don't want to see hardware coming in through the door. I want it to go onto my virtualization pod, unless there's a good reason why it can't. So some of you are taking computer forensics with Ashley. Computer forensics uses a software called Encase. Encase needs a USB installed into it. Not really good for a virtualized environment, right? If that were to migrate hosts, the USB doesn't migrate hosts with it. So now it's plugged into a different machine. Now it can't access it. Now you can't access the software. Bad things happen. We want you to be able to access the software all the time. So maybe we have a specific physical server that's going to host that software and it's going to stay physical. Again, there are ways around it. There are things that you can do to make it virtualized, but for ease of use, maybe we don't. Again, that's a one-on-one decision that you make with your business. But eventually, we want to try to move everything that we can into the virtual environment so we have a single place of control, a single place that we can access it. So again, our hypervisors are going to allow us to run multiple virtual servers on a single host. Fewer physical servers are being used, and the resources that are being used are going to be consumed more efficiently. So again, as we get into the different types of hypervisors, the way that the hypervisors control their functions, we'll see that they're going to allow us to assign memory to virtual machines, and it's going to allow us to assign more memory than physically exists in the server. So our servers here, or our workstations here, each have 32 gigabytes of memory, of RAM. We're going to be able to use our consolidation ratio and maybe assign 10 times that amount of RAM to our virtual machines. As servers need more, our hypervisors are going to take care of that, move it over, move it around, spread it out. As they need less, it'll take it back. That gives us the ability to utilize resources in a more efficient manner. Same with CPU. So again, we have i5s installed on the machine here. They each have quad cores, so we have four CPUs that we can associate with virtual machines. We're going to be able to make more than just four virtual machines that each take one core. Because CPU power, again, if it's not being used, it's just sitting around idle. So we're going to be able to split it out, do what's called time division multiplexing. Your word of the day, time division multiplexing. So it's going to be able to take those threads of the CPU and spread them out over multiple machines, have multiple machines running efficiently all at the same time, utilizing fewer resources. So again, I said these workstations here have 32 gigabytes of RAM, and they all have four CPU cores. Which resource do you think is in contention the most, CPU or RAM? Some people say CPU, some people say RAM. Type 1 hypervisor. Nope, RAM. Yep. Again, when you install Windows, what's your requirements to install Windows? One CPU and 8 gigabytes of RAM? So we may have more RAM,
but our virtual machines are going to take more RAM.
CPU, really?
It sits around idle. It's come to the point that it has so many cycles that most of the time the CPU isn't in contention.
So in a small environment such as this, it's true. In a large environment, it's true as well.
And most of the machines aren't going to be taking computationally complex things that's going to require CPU, unless you're a couple people in here and you're doing things that require CPU. No names, no software names that require computationally complex processes, but for the most part, again, RAM is going to be what's in contention.
Virtualization is going to provide a return on investment by removing the cost of the infrastructure.
Again, we don't need to power those devices anymore. Instead of having our 10 physical servers that exist in our environment, now we're going to power one virtual host, right? So we've reduced our cost by 1/10 for electricity.
We only have one server we need to cool. Our room's going to be a lot cooler by nature, so we have less HVAC costs.
We only have to plug in a few ports on a switch, right? We've reduced the amount of switches that we need in our environment to host those. So again, all around, we're reducing costs.
At what point does it become important to virtualize?
That was your first short paper, your first assignment.
Again, you're going to find different answers.
A lot of people say five servers. A lot of people say 10 servers.
Again, it's a complex topic. There's no real right answer. It depends on the environment. It depends on what you're running. It depends on how you're running it. Things that you can look at are licensing costs. Again, is it cheaper to go out and buy a PC that has Windows on it, or is it cheaper to buy a Windows license? Pretty scary how expensive Windows licensing is. Usually it's a lot cheaper to go out and buy an OEM machine and use Windows OEM licensing than it is to buy a Windows license for a PC. Pretty scary. But again, as you look at it, depending on what you're trying to do, depending on how you go out, you'll have different answers. Again, I talked VDI, virtual desktop infrastructure, not just servers.
So again, do you give everybody a PC in your environment, or do you give them all thin clients or zero clients? How are you having them connect? How are you deploying that software to them?
If you have a virtualized desktop environment, you're going to make one image. That's going to be your gold image. Your gold image is going to be pushed out to everybody.
In terms of management, when you go to update that image, you're updating one device, and it gets pushed out to everybody else.
How much time is saved by not having to go out to 100 PCs to do updates, right?
So much time, so much travel, so much effort.
But again, it depends on your environment. Maybe your environment only has 5 PCs. Maybe your environment only has 50 PCs. At what point does it start to switch over and make more sense? Again, you still have to worry about licensing. You have to worry about software costs. So those have a factor in your decision whether or not to virtualize it.
Again, you guys are all starting to learn virtual machines for the first time. If I asked you to go and install Windows, you all know how to do that. If I asked you to go and install a virtualized environment, nobody knows how to do that, right? So there's a learning curve. You have to be able to go and you have to study it. If you run into a problem, what happens if you're using a virtualized environment? Maybe your whole environment is down. That would not be a good thing.
What happens when one PC fails? That one PC is down.
You have to think about things like that in your environment as well.
Again, we talked about VMware 2001. Some places you'll see are 99. 99 is when the company was formed, 1999. 2001 is really when it first came to market. Again, they saw the need for people to virtualize environments. CPUs are sitting around idle. We can combine these servers into one device. We can use one device to fit our needs. So they pushed that out. They sold that. People bought that. People were happy with it. Hopefully some of you have seen this before or know this information. Hopefully y'all can spot the grievous error that's on this slide.
see it. So this byte size goes to say how many bits are in a byte, how many bytes are in a kilobyte, how many kilobytes are in a megabyte. There's 1,024 gigabytes in 1 gigabyte. Ooh, no, there isn't. That's an error. So, yeah, this should be megabytes instead of gigabytes. We'll forgive them. But again, it's a factor of 1024. So you just need to be aware of that. Things can grow out of control. I got to try to find this picture that I saw. It was really awesome how it explained it. And it said if one byte is 1 grain of rice, then 1 kilobyte is 1 bag of rice. And if 1 kilobyte is 1 bag of rice, 1 megabyte is a truck of rice. And then if 1 truck of rice is a megabyte, then 1 ship is a gigabyte. And then as you get down to petabyte, petabyte is rice that fills New York. Pretty big, right? And then exabytes, the world. So, kind of gives you a perspective. When we talk size, it used to be memory was expensive. Back in the day when memory was expensive, programmers took care. We're lazy now. We don't take care. We don't care about size. It used to be that you could fit Windows on a 100 megabyte hard drive, right? Good luck with the newer versions of Windows. What size usually do you allocate to a new install of Windows? Was that? At least 20 gigs? I usually do 80 to be safe. Yeah, 20 is just for the OS. 40 will work, but if you try to install the updates on a 40 gig drive, it crashes because it can't download the updates to install them. So I usually recommend 80. And we'll talk about those kinds of things and those kinds of ideas and the way that we can save space in terms of storage in our hypervisor as we move forward here. So really, that's it for chapter one. Pretty straightforward, right? Any questions on anything that we talked about there? Anything that doesn't make sense? Pretty straightforward. So in chapter two, we actually start talking about hypervisors. Again, as we start out this course, I cover two chapters. This is why we cover two chapters, because it's basic ideas, things that make sense. We've all dealt with computers long enough that the ideas that we're talking here are pretty straightforward. They make sense. I'm not surprising anybody. Nobody's jumping up and down out of the seat going, "You're wrong!" That happens in Visual Basic occasionally, just saying. So with hypervisors, they start to make sense. So again, we'll define what a hypervisor is. We'll talk about the differences of type 1 and type 2 hypervisors and the different roles that they play. Some of the history of the hypervisors in the commercial market as we move through this chapter. So again, what is a hypervisor? A hypervisor is going to be the software that abstracts the hardware resource from the virtual machine. As far as the virtual machine is concerned, it is actually plugged into physical hardware and is working alone. Again, that goes back to the idea of isolation. It doesn't know that it's in a virtual environment. It doesn't need to know that it's in a virtual environment. It needs to know what hardware it has access to. And the way that it knows it has hardware access is through the hypervisor. The hypervisor is going to delegate, manage, control all the interactions. Hypervisor, again, virtual machine manager, virtual machine monitor, lots of different names out there. Everybody nowadays says hypervisor. I don't know anybody that doesn't use the term hypervisor now. They can. It exists. Again, they run directly on hardware or as an application in the operating system. Again, not really a new concept. Started in the 60s, published in the 70s. Nowadays, widespread commercial use. A lot of people use them. Type 1 hypervisor is going to run directly on top of the hardware. Type 1 hypervisors are going to be more secure, more available. They offer better performance to the guest operating system. There's no overhead with their interaction. Type 1 hypervisors have direct access to what's called ring zero of the architecture. They can talk directly to the hardware. Make sense? So when I go to install a Type 1 hypervisor, I put the disk directly into the machine. I would install it like I would install Windows, like I would install Linux or any other operating system. But again, a Type 1 hypervisor is not an operating system. It's going to be software that manages the interaction between its guest operating systems and the physical hardware.
So the virtual machine on top, that would be like a workstation?
So that could be a server or that could be a workstation up top. So the guest operating system can be anything that your hypervisor supports.
And then,
again, your hypervisor is going to dictate what operating systems it supports. VMware is more forgiving. It lets you install things like Windows NT. Why, I don't know, but it does, and they work.
So it takes. So the hypervisor is taking, say their workstations. It's just taking and knows all the resources that are available.
So when we go to create our virtual guest operating systems, we're going to tell it what resources are available.
So it does it automatically.
So I think what you're getting at is if you have a workstation that already exists,
right,
and you're trying to move it into a virtual environment. So again, we'll talk about that more as we go along, but that's what's called a physical to virtual conversion.
Okay.
When you go to do a physical to virtual conversion or a P2V, what it does is it scans the hardware, learns all of it, the things that are required, the number of CPUs that it has, the size of the RAM, the hard disk space, and then brings it back when it creates that virtual machine with the guest operating. Again, if you're going to start from scratch, what we're going to do is we're going to tell it. This is going to have one CPU. This is going to have two CPUs. This is going to have four CPUs. It's going to have 4 gigs of RAM, 16 gigs of RAM. And we'll learn as we go on creating those virtual machines. We don't want to think of those as physical machines. So when you go out to actually purchase a physical machine, you're going to look for something that has 4 cores, something that has an i7, something that has 32 gigs of RAM or 64 gigs of RAM or some ridiculous number of RAM. When we go to create our machine, we want to take a minimalist approach. It's very easy in a virtual environment to add resources. So when we go to create a Windows 7 instance, we're going to give it one CPU, we're going to give it 4 gigs of RAM. Through the performance of the machine, we're going to monitor it and see if it needs more. In some instances, with some applications, you know that it will need more. File sharing, Pixie booting, things of that nature. You'll see it spike. You'll see that it needs more resources. You can give it more resources at that time. It's more difficult to take away resources from a virtual machine that you've created. Usually you have to power it off. Then you take it down, then you turn it back on, the operating system has to recompute all its things and changes its page file size and all that nature to recognize that new hardware. Again, different software out there behaves differently. So if I go and I install in my virtual environment an SQL server, SQL by default takes 80% of the available RAM. So I install on a 4 gig system, immediately it takes 80% of that RAM. I install it on a 16 gig system, 80% of the RAM. I install it on a 64 gigabytes of memory, takes 80% of that memory. So it looks like it's using 64 or 80% of 64 gigs of memory right off the bat. It's not. It likes to tell you it is, but it's not. It's not going to use that much. So again, if we take that minimalist approach and we build it up, we see that it's using 90% of the memory when it's on. Okay, maybe we want to go and add. So Type 1 hypervisor, again, in this class, we're going to talk VMware vSphere, ESXi hosts. We're going to talk Microsoft Hyper-V. And we're going to talk Xen. So those are going to be our Type 1 hosts. Again, with the Type 1 host, you're installing it directly on hardware. So you don't have that operating system interaction. So they tend to be than the Type 2 hypervisors. Type 2 hypervisors kind of run on top of an operating system. So again, at our base, we'll have our physical server. On top of our physical server, we're going to install our operating system. Our operating system could be Linux, could be Windows, could be Mac, whatever we want. Then within that operating system, we're going to install software that's going to act as our Type 2 hypervisor. So examples of this, Oracle Box, VMware Player, VMware Workstation. Other ones, there's lots of them. Linux KVM can be Type 2. Your book goes over VMware Player. VMware Player's free. VMware Player Pro apparently is not free. It's the one I found the other night. VMware Fusion for Mac, not free. VMware Workstation, not free. Oracle VBox is free, built on the Xen architecture. And what they do is they leverage the operating system drivers. So the hardware that it sees is the information that it gets from the operating system. So if you have the driver installed within Windows, within your Mac operating system, within your Linux operating system, then the virtual machines will be able to access those hardware information as well. It works at what's called Ring 3. Ring 3 is the application layer of the x86 architecture. Again, it doesn't have permission to talk to the hardware directly. So what it needs to do is say, may I please have access to your network interface card? May I please have access to your hardware? May I please have access to your hard drive? And the operating system takes its time slice and goes, okay, or no. Maybe it says no, you can't. I'm Windows, you can't do that. Type 2 hypervisors, if you have a 32-bit machine and you install a Type 2 hypervisor, you can't install a 64-bit operating system, right? Makes sense. If you only have 32 lanes on your highway, you can't all of a sudden add 64. It doesn't work out that way. 64 to 32, that's fine. Doesn't care. So just be aware of that. So if your guest operating system is the 32-bit version of the operating system, you're not going to be able to install 64-bit operating systems. Type 2 hypervisors often used for desktop development and testing. So I use Type 2 hypervisors in my exchange class. I've used them in my penetration testing class. Not yet this semester, but I will. And again, it allows you to do things within other operating systems without having to exit out, without having to have separate hardware. So I don't have a computer now that's my Linux computer, a computer that's my Windows computer, a computer that's my Mac. Right? I have one that does everything. So now I'm only carrying one device. It's not true I carry two, but could be true. It also allows developers to write their software and test their software without ever leaving their screen. And how is this going to react when it hits Windows 8 instead of Windows 7? How's it going to react when it hits Windows 10? You can test that right from your desktop and how that works without having to test on separate physical machines. So again, I said we're going to talk VMware ESXi. ESXi is the software that's installed directly on top of the host. I also mentioned vSphere. vSphere is the software that talks to all the separate ESXi hosts. So if we have more than one ESXi host, we can talk in one place through vSphere. Separate software, kind of used interchangeably if you're looking at any VMware information. So again, it's going to load all the information directly on top of the hardware. It's going to load the resources there. Again, it was the first commercially available hypervisor. Again, here now they're quoting 1998 instead of 2001. 1998 was when the company was founded. 2001 was when they actually started releasing software for the x86 platform. Again, they're currently the market leader in user share and maturity of their offerings. They've been around the longest. A lot of people are comfortable with VMware. VMware does wonderful things, so a lot of people like it. Again, what drives people to switch away from VMware doesn't meet their needs. too expensive. Other highly available software is out there, so they can switch over. But there hasn't been a lot of movement from that VMware platform. Again, the architecture not tied to an operating system. So you install ESXi directly on top of the host. It's going to control all the interactions. VMware is what they call a monolithic operating system. Monolithic in the term that all of the drivers are installed via the hypervisor. So your guest operating systems are going to use the drivers that VMware tells it it can use. It's not going to interact directly with the hardware. It's going to interact with the hypervisor. Make sense? Okay. Another one is Xen. Xen looks a little more like Linux. Again, it's free. You have your kernels, your DOMs. It interacts through the hypervisor to the hardware. You can actually install device-specific drivers within your guest operating systems. So this is what's called a microkernelized design. Microkernelized meaning you can have different guest operating systems with different drivers. So maybe on your host you have this really cool NVIDIA graphics card that does certain things, or maybe you have a specific NIC card that does like packet injection, and you don't want all devices to have access to it, and you want to install this driver separately, Xen will allow you to do that, VMware won't. So again, when I talked VMware, I talked hardware compatibility list. That hardware compatibility list is because it only works with certain hardware drivers, and those hardware drivers are defined by the hypervisor. Microsoft Hyper-V, again, this is going to look a little more like Windows. Again, it's the microkernelized design, so the device drivers are in the specific instances of the guest operating system. They don't all come from the hypervisor. Again, it first came out in 2008. When it came out in 2008, it was a virtual PC. Very crappy software. But it was the only way to run Windows on the Mac operating system at the time. And again, the Mac operating system's changed. Now it's BSD Linux, basically. So there is still boot camp. So boot camp is just the Windows drivers. And what allows for boot camp on the Mac OS is now Mac uses Intel hardware. So it's all the same hardware. It's not separate hardware interactions. So it makes it a lot easier for that cross-platform architectures. Hyper-V, again, is a Type 1 hypervisor, so it installs directly on top of the hardware. So on day one, I kind of tricked you in class here. I had you install Server 2012. The reason that I had you install Server 2012 is because we're going to use Hyper-V. Hyper-V doesn't work on top of the operating system. Again, one of those mind things, you have to get your mind around it. Hyper-V is a Type 1 hypervisor. It talks to the hardware directly. So we're going to interface through Hyper-V using Server 2012 R2, but really Server 2012 R2 isn't needed to use Hyper-V. Microsoft Hyper-V is free as long as you're not using Windows software, right? So you can install Hyper-V on your server, install as many copies of Ubuntu as you want, and run Ubuntu free. You can install Hyper-V. If you go to install Windows Server 2012 R2, you need a software license. So what you do is you pay for the Microsoft site license, you install Server 2012, and then you install the access to Hyper-V. And again, we'll do that today as a part of our lab, is actually set up the Hyper-V role and talk about how we're going to create different things. Again, the way that everything's divided out, it makes it look like Microsoft Windows. Again, it was developed by Windows, so it looks and acts and feels like Windows, and that's okay. As I said, there's other software out there. We'll talk about Xen, but there's Red Hat Kernel Virtual Machine Manager, or KVM, kernel-based. So when you go to actually download Linux KVM, you have to actually download a separate distribution and install it. It's not a standalone. I have not taken the opportunity to do that because I'm not Linux guru. And again, when we looked at our Gartner chart there, it was down in the corner away from everybody else. So really me taking the time to learn that until it gets up to be a major player is not worth my time. If it's something that you want to utilize and it's something that you want to do, I encourage you to do it. If you can take it to a business and sell it and get them to run Linux kernel KVM and have their entire virtualization operating system run on that, that's great, right? You're going to save them a ton of money by not having to buy Microsoft licenses. You're going to save them a ton of money by not having to buy VMware licenses. But you're going to have to convince them that a support model exists that you can guarantee their uptime. Not really going to happen. You could try. Probably not going to happen. Oracle VM, again, is Zen-based. We're going to talk Zen. Again, there's other solutions out there. So Oracle bought Sun a while ago, which is what facilitated that. So that's available. And again, there's lots of other hypervisors out there that do it. There's still room to grow. Again, there's better ways to do virtualization than is done now. Interoperability is huge, so you want to make sure that it works with everything that's out there. So these developers have spent a lot of money to do that. If you're a software engineer and you're going and you're writing your own, maybe you don't make it backwards compatible. So yours is going to run smaller and faster, but only on newer operating systems. There may be a market for that. Again, depending on where you are, what you're doing, how you want to proceed, me, I go and buy a solution. It's easier than writing my own. So again, we talked about the different types of hypervisors, type 1, type 2. That's an important distinction. We talked about monolithic hypervisors. Again, the drivers are installed within the hypervisor, not within the guest operating system. We talked about microkernelized hypervisors. Again, you can choose to install what drivers you want within your hypervisor, and that's going to make a difference. And again, we showed different types and how different types interact with the hypervisor. Any questions on any of that? Pretty straightforward. So that's it for Chapter 2. So now you have all of the chapter materials to answer the first quiz. Again, you can take that quiz as many times as you want. If there's questions that come up, something that doesn't make sense from the book or from the lecture here, let me know, and we can address that. Yes?
And these PowerPoints are available to us?
Yep, these PowerPoints are also on CM Connect, so you can download those. And I just recorded what I just said, so that will be available as well.
For the quizzes, do we, like, submit them and then they reopen? Or?
Yep, so you submit them, but don't turn them in. As soon as you turn them in, it keeps the grade.